all the big tech platforms got together and kicked off, right?
That name should be bleeped if this is going on YouTube, FYI.
Can we not say his name?
You cannot say his name.
No way.
What are, like, the top things you see people doing that makes you, like, facepalm?
Using a home assistant is a big one.
Like Google Home or Alexa.
Yeah,
or
using a home assistant actually puts me on edge. Anytime I enter somebody's home, it feels like I'm not in their home. It feels like I'm in somebody else's home. Pretty much everything related to privacy in the big tech world is a lie. When you sign up for a lot of these accounts, the privacy policy is almost like an anti-privacy policy. When you go and you read it, it really tells you about how your data has no privacy. And they ask you to agree to this. And then at the same time, they tell you that we take your security very seriously. And we care about your data and all of this other stuff. But you look at the privacy policy and it's several pages of how they're screwing you over and how they're destroying your privacy. You agree that your data can be shared with all of these random companies. Who knows? Maybe other people that we don't even list here. And we can use this to track and monitor you and for pretty much whatever else. And sometimes they say that they even get control of your and ownership of your data as well, whatever you post. So these are all big tech Silicon Valley lies.
And what am I supposed to do about that? You know, it's like there's a privacy policy and my choices are accept or don't use the app, right?
Those are your two choices. And I recommend don't use the app. It requires a choice on both the user's behalf and on the developer's behalf. The developers who are making these apps have to make the choice that they're going to take the hard road. They're not going to take the easy road, and they're not going to make the apps kind of the traditional way. They're not going to use all of these insecure databases. They have to put a lot of effort into actually securing the data. So the developers have to decide to do the hard thing and to actually secure the data. So that's the choice that the developers have to make. And then the choice that the users have to make is they have to find these developers, because a lot of the time, those developers don't have big marketing budgets. They're putting all of their energy and effort and resources into actually making the app secure. But on the other hand, they have very little money left over to spreading the word out. They can't buy billboards in Silicon Valley that you read as you drive through the city. They can't buy commercials. They can't they can't do all of this marketing that attracts all of these users. So users have to put in a little bit of an effort too to actually go and find the apps that developers who care about them, you know, have created, and then actually use those apps.
So it's expensive to create data secure apps, actually private apps, right? But at the same time, like, why, you know, we've got Google, Facebook, Apple, these companies that have enormous budgets. Why aren't they delivering us data secure apps?
Well, in some cases, some of these companies actually do. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Apple, for example, with iCloud, did start to put some effort into what is called end-to-end encryption. End-to-end encryption is kind of the, when it's done correctly, it's the gold standard of data protection. When you send your data to the company's servers, that your data is not going to be visible to the company. It means that the data is going to be encrypted on their servers, and it can only be decrypted and read by the people who are authorized to actually read it. And when I say authorized, I don't mean the company. I don't mean the government. I mean whoever is supposed to have access to that data. So if I have some data that I'm backing up, that data is mine and mine only to read. And if I want to give somebody else access to that data, only they should be able to have access to it. And sometimes some of these companies do put some effort into it. Apple tried a little bit to add end-to-end encryption to iCloud, but it was disabled by default. And users would have to know to enable the setting. And Apple would also, strangely enough, would allow users to upload and you upload their data to iCloud while that setting was disabled, in other words. So if they enable it after the fact, what point is there in enabling this end-to-end encryption after the fact if you've already given your data in the clear to Apple? It kind of defeats the purpose of it. And recently, in their battle with the United Kingdom, they decided to completely disable this feature for all of their United Kingdom customers. So big tech actually does have the resources to care about their users' privacy. But for whatever reason, be it market forces or other reasons, they tend to not do it.
When you trust Apple, Google, whoever it is, any of these big tech companies to handle your data security, let's say they do build a really great end-to-end encrypted whatever service you're using. Well, it sounds like they can just decide to yoink that at any time that they want, because like I may have a Gmail account, but I don't have any control over the decisions that are made at Google, right? Other than maybe they want me to be kind of happy because I will continue to use their service. But what's the solve for that? How do we live in an environment where we maybe actually have control over, you know, not just this is secure and end-to-end encrypted right now, but I know that this is still going to be secure in the future?
That's a good question. So what you have to do is you have to seek out, find, and use software that has been built from the ground up, from the start, with end-to-end encryption in mind and with the user's privacy in mind. Some of the things to look for are, does the company or organization say that their software is end-to-end encrypted? If they say it's end-to-end encrypted, great. That's one check mark. That's an important check mark. Then do they say that it's open source? This is another important check mark, because that goes to your question of whether or not they will then be able to in the future kind of do a rug pull on their customers, so to speak. You know, maybe start out end-to-end encrypted and then for whatever reason change their mind about it. If it's open source, it makes it a little bit harder for them to do that. And it also makes it easier for security experts to actually look at what they're doing and see, well, do their claims actually live up to reality or not? So open source means transparency. So that people can look at the source code and see if there are any bugs in there or see if there are any architectural flaws in their end-to-end encryption. So end-to-end encryption, open source, and then one final check mark, which is very hard to find, but there are people doing this, including us, and that is some kind of decentralization. That's the biggest thing that kind of gives you that guarantee that this is a company or an organization who is creating something that will be there for the long haul. If their protocol, if they have a protocol, like to begin with, and if their protocol is decentralized, that tells you that that is basically going to be there in stone for a long time. Because a decentralized protocol is something that allows other developers, other than this company, in other words, to create software that communicates with their software as well, and allows them to do so independently. And what that means is that they can't mess with whatever they've designed and change it significantly. Because if they did, then all of a sudden, all of these independent groups would no longer be able to work in that ecosystem. So some examples of decentralized protocols include email. Email has been around for many, many decades, and it is still used to this day. Another one is BitTorrent, and others include things like Bitcoin. That's one of the biggest names that come to most people's mind when they hear the word decentralized. But actually, decentralized protocols have existed since the internet began. Most of the low-level protocols that power the internet are, in fact, decentralized.
And can you just unpack what that means a little bit? What does it mean for something to be centralized versus decentralized?
Yeah, it's actually not easy to make something decentralized. So when a company or an organization says that their thing is decentralized, they might be lying. They might not be telling you the truth, or they might simply be mistaken. There might be some hidden centralization somewhere in their system. It's not easy to create a decentralized system. And what does it mean for something to be decentralized? It means that there's no central point of control. The traditional way of doing things is a centralized approach. So there's a company like Apple or Google or Facebook, and there are managers at these companies, and they say, well, I want things done this way. Okay, now a few years have passed. I've changed my mind. I want things done this other way, and I want you to completely change the product that we have. I want you to completely redesign it, do something else, make something different. That is a centralized approach to creating software. And that is something that you can't rely on and depend on, because centralized systems are very easy to, first of all, change. And they're very easy also, therefore, to coerce as well into changing. Whereas decentralized systems are difficult to change. They're purposefully created in a way that's very difficult to change in order for them to be able to last for a long period of time.
Are there any common misconceptions you hear all the time that people believe about how our data is handled right now?
A lot of awareness has been raised on this specific topic about what's done with our data. So a lot of people are now used to the idea of targeted advertising, for example. And so they know that anything that they post to Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram or whatever can be used to create a shadow profile on them that then is sold in this data broker market that's sold to companies so that they can provide people with more relevant ads. That is, on the one hand, a positive thing, but it can also be something that can be abused to track and surveil people and manipulate them as well.
I mean, most of us out there have, even if we know about the risks, even if we know that our data is being sold, even if we kind of, we've heard about these leaks, these data breaches that happen, people's identities getting stolen, I think a lot of us kind of rationalize and say, It's not going to happen to me. How likely is this? Who's actually going to see this? Who cares about my little life, right? What's the real risk I'm taking there?
The number of risks that people take in using the existing kind of software that we have in, you know, the current world out there are actually almost incalculable. It's not just that data brokers can serve you more relevant ads. That's kind of one of the big talking points that has been brought up in recent times. But using the systems that we have around today, what people oftentimes don't understand is that these centralized systems, these centralized social networks especially, they are very brittle. They're very easy to manipulate. They are in fact designed that way. The company can manipulate the information that's on their servers in any way that they want. And hackers can obtain that information, but also sometimes you have to worry about the company because censorship is a huge problem on many of these platforms. And the kind of censorship that's now possible and is actively being done on these platforms will blow some people's minds.
Let's talk about it. I think that's a great place to go because especially, you know, every time the political winds blow a different way, I'm sure certain groups of people become afraid of being exposed. And I think right now we have an administration that cares a little bit less about the rule of law and how the way that things are supposed to be done. And we've seen Silicon Valley really be pretty willing to bend to the whims of this new administration. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it just makes what censorship looks like in this country right now particularly relevant for, you know, how we live our lives online.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to pick on this administration. I'll pick on all of them. Please. I'll say that all of the previous administrations have their own particular groups that they don't like, et cetera, and they'll pick on. And this should concern all of us because, you know, as you rightly point out, one day this group will be in power, the next day another group will be in power. And with these systems that we have, they're so very brittle. And what they don't have is this concept of data integrity in any way. So it's not just about end-to-end encryption. Sometimes people want to have communications in public and say things publicly and for those communications to not be end-to-end encrypted. But what they don't have is data integrity. And they don't have the ability, for example, to ensure that the conversation that's being had is, in fact, the conversation that people see. So many things can be done on these platforms for example, where sometimes you'll be looking at a thread and then parts of that thread will get chopped off by the moderators of these platforms, and you won't realize that. So somebody will be having a conversation, and they'll say, like, you know, oh, I like red shoes. And somebody will say, oh, are you sure? You know, sometimes red shoes are kind of flashy, and they have this problem, and maybe the conversation stops at that point. But, for example, on Twitter, it'll show you, at least for now, that there are a little number 6 underneath that thread. And there could have been an entire long conversation after that point, but there are no replies. You look at there, and it doesn't even show the replies under show more. They're just not visible at all. You actually literally have to sometimes go to people's individual profiles to see that the conversation had continued, and that the person was in fact persuaded that now they no longer like red shoes. They in fact like green shoes. So you walk away from that conversation thinking that Joe is a big fan of red shoes, but in the reality is that he was persuaded that red shoes are not his favorite color after all. In fact, they're green shoes, for example. I've seen this with my own eyes. These are the kinds of subtle manipulations that can happen on these platforms. That's just one. And that's an example of something that I've personally witnessed many times. Other manipulations can be even worse than this. Like, these are theoretical ones that I haven't actually seen, but they're possible with the kinds of architecture that these companies have. For example, somebody could post a tweet saying, I like red shoes. But that actual tweet could then be manipulated and changed to make it seem like the person said they liked green shoes. There's nothing preventing this from happening. The only thing is that if the company is caught doing that, of course, their reputation will get worse. But these companies have been caught doing various nefarious things, like interrupting the flows of conversations to, you know, to shift the perspective of the audience in one way or another. That's already very shady. So what's stopping them from taking the next step and just putting words in people's mouths? There isn't much preventing them. In fact, their software does support that capability. We could make software that prevents that from happening, literally makes it impossible for that to happen.
And we might not even know if it has happened already, right? Because it's possible.
Right.
So we have no idea. That's kind of the scary thing, is that all of this is happening, and with the current framework, the current way that things work, we just can't know unless we experience it firsthand for ourselves.
Right.
You said we can build software where it's impossible for that kind of thing to happen. What's the difference? Like, what makes it impossible? What is it that cannot be done, or that is possible right now, that can be made impossible, that'll change all this?
So what can be done is introducing the use of actual cryptography into the messaging protocols that these platforms support. By using cryptography, you can do a few things. You can guarantee, for example, that messages have digital signatures on them, and that only people who are authorized to write messages are allowed to write messages. You can also guarantee that messages that are written in the past cannot be tampered with or modified. You can do various different things to kind of give a strong, solid foundation for the actual platform on top of which conversation can occur.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing that, you know, these platforms like X or Facebook or anybody can do now is they can make accounts disappear. They can make your likes disappear. They can ban users, right? They basically have the power. They can modify conversations. They can do whatever they want, right? And I think there's a moment we all remember, which is when all the big tech platforms got together and kicked off, right?
That name should be bleeped if this is going on YouTube, FYI.
Can we not say his name?
You cannot say his name.
No way.
What can we
talk about it?
Oh, really? Wow.
There is a certain personality.
Seriously?
A certain media personality. You can say that, yeah. But
there is a certain... Okay, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Whoa. Okay. Well, I'm dumbfounded that you can't say the name of this certain media personality. So there's a certain media personality yeah. who was banned at the same time by all the big tech platforms, right? And he's a polarizing person, and I think many people were happy to see him go in some ways because of the things that he's said and done in the past. But at the same time, I think it's a little hard to watch someone get banned by some of the most powerful entities in the world that are unelected, you know, mega corporations, and realize that, like, the town square, this thing that's this digital town square, is something that ultimately we have no power over. And I'm wondering if you can help us just unpack and understand that moment and what that meant.
Yeah, that was a very disturbing moment, because that was kind of a mask off moment, basically, where any pretense of freedom of speech was just thrown out the window. But it was also revealing that these companies can collude with one another and act like a digital government over cyberspace, basically. And that is scary, because they collectively banned this person from multiple different big tech platforms pretty much at the same time. So that shows that this isn't really, you know, they were saying, some people try to defend this and say that, oh, they're private companies, they can do whatever they want. But when they're all acting in collusion with one another, and they all pretty much have control over like 95% of the conversation that happens on at least the Western internet, that is the behavior of a government, essentially, that can censor what is and is not allowed to be said online. And that is, you know, a serious problem, especially in a country like America, where we value freedom of speech so highly. So they did eventually have their account restored on X, but not on other platforms necessarily. That is a situation that, that's problematic. Then decentralized technologies can prevent that kind of stuff from happening. What they do is they take power from the center, from these big tech CEOs, and they kind of distribute that power out into the hands of the people. And so if some people don't like what this person has to say, they can not follow that person, they can block that person, etc. But at least it's their choice, and it's not somebody else making that decision on their behalf.
What are like the top things you see people doing that makes you like facepalm?
Using a home assistant is a big one.
Like Google Home or Alexa.
Yeah, using a home assistant actually puts me on edge. Anytime I enter somebody's home and they say they have one of those things, like it puts me on edge, because it feels like I'm not in their home. It feels like I'm in somebody else's home. You know, I have no idea who's on the other end of that device. There are stories of people getting phone calls from like Amazon employees calling in on them, like either worried for their safety or, you know, who knows what, or maybe like because somebody said something that was taken out of context, etc. The Amazon employees listening to different conversations. Like you can read various stories online about these kinds of incidents. So just why? That's what comes to mind. Why would you do that to yourself? No.
What about just like the assistant, like on your phone, if you have Siri or something like that?
If the assistant is not entirely doing all of the processing locally on your device, I would not use it. And as far as I know, most, if not all of those assistants send the audio data to centralized service over the internet. I would never use an assistant that does that. That makes no sense to me at all.
I'm pretty sure the Google Assistant sends it over the internet, because it doesn't work when you don't have a network.
Yeah, and that's another thing, is that, you know, what happens if your internet goes down? Why do you even want a product that can't work if the internet goes down? It makes no sense to me. It's like a broken product.
Okay, are there any other things that you see people do? And it's like we all just don't know better, but are there those things that you see people do and you go, why are you doing this? You need to stop immediately.
Anytime they are sending text messages to one another using an insecure messenger, it just makes no sense to me. Why do you want to have a conversation that's basically public? There's no reason to do that. You can easily replace that in like 5 seconds with an end-to-end encrypted messenger. Like, for example, Signal or Delta Chat or, you know, various different other end-to-end encrypted messengers that have been released over the years.
Yeah, so don't use your iChat or your built-in messenger on your Android phone or whatever.
Well, iMessages, for example, Apple alleges that they're end-to-end encrypted, but they are only end-to-end encrypted between iPhones. So if you talk to somebody with an Android device, they're not end-to-end encrypted anymore.
But you shouldn't have to worry about that if you have an Apple, because you're not supposed to talk to the Android people.
I mean, that just seems like a weird thing to do.
I agree.
Yeah.
It's weird. I've heard Apple people be like, "Ew, Android." And I'm like, it's just your phone. Come on. I buy whatever phone is affordable and fine.
Well, I use Graphene OS, which is an Android derivative. So.
Well, what is that?
GrapheneOS is a hardened, secure, security-focused version of Android.
We don't have to look at the world and accept the way things are. There's this amazing quote by Ursula Le Guin that I'm going to maybe butcher, but it was something like, it's hard to, I think she was talking about capitalism, but she was like, it's hard to imagine, a world after capitalism, but it was really hard for serfs to imagine a world without the divine right of kings, So maybe it's hard for us to imagine a world without the divine right of Silicon Valley, but you're building it.
Yeah. We're not just building it. We've already released one piece of software that has it. Group Income exists today. It's free and open source. You can use it right now. And it's a great way for a small group of people to provide themselves with a financial safety net. And it also has pretty much all of the features of Slack or Discord built into it. So it's great for doing a community chat as well.
Yeah. Can you tell me what is Group Income exactly?
So Group Income is a way of doing your, basically it's like do-it-yourself social security. Instead of giving money to the government to collect when you're old and falling apart, you can help your current group of friends or family or community with a financial safety net now, because a lot of people need it now. And Group Income lets them do it in a way that's completely private and end-to-end encrypted. And you can also use it to communicate with each other. You can, use it to share cat photos or videos, and you can, you can also use it to collaborate on projects as well, develop new software, develop a new app using Chelonia when we release it. It's got all the bells and whistles of a software like Slack or Discord.
I like that you built this app that's, for building this, this financial safety net amongst your social network, but you're like, oh, and by the way, we also just built, a Slack Discord equivalent thing.
Yeah.
That's just there for you.
Yeah. Yeah. The reason we were able to do that was because honestly, we had a great team together, and some of the developers who weren't working on the end-to-end encryption stuff just were waiting on us to build out the framework, the end-to-end encryption stuff. And we were like, oh, there's another, chat related feature where you guys could be working on in the meantime. Like they're just waiting on us basically.
What was it that made you decide to build Group Income?
So what made me decide to create Group Income was seeing people personally who are close to me struggle financially. And I wanted to see fewer people in that position. And I also knew that there are people whose the spark of life in them, their talents, their genius is just being crushed by the way that we've created society, crushed by these financial chains of having to work at a job they don't like, doing things they don't want to do just to pay the bills so that they could have food and shelter. So much of humanity's potential could be unleashed if we fixed that problem. So that's where my inspiration for working on Group Income came from.
I like that. And I think that a lot of us maybe are sitting around hoping that the government will solve this problem for us. And, maybe someday we will build a government where we all, we all get our piece and we're able to contribute how we want to contribute. But
some governments solve problems. Other governments create problems.
Some do both at once.
Yeah. Some do both at once. Yeah. So you can, sit around and wait for them to either make things better or make things worse, or you could, take charge and do it yourself.
It's interesting. You know what? Group Income reminds me a little bit of the first first insurance, because first insurance wasn't just like a company, right? It was literally communities getting together and pooling some money so that they could cover things when something happened to somebody, right? I like that you're taking that and you're kind of shrinking it back down into your social network. And I don't mean your online social network. I mean like the people that you actually know and care about.
Yeah.
You said it was based on what's the number of people that you can have relationships with?
Oh yeah. Group Income is designed around Dunbar's number, which is, It's the average number of meaningful relationships that a person can have with people. And that number was found to be about 150. So we don't allow groups to grow beyond that size. We have plans for how to scale it for situations involving larger groups of people. But we need to make sure that group income does not contribute to the fraud problem in the Social Security system. So the main problem is that if you have a difficult time validating people's identities, you will not be able to prevent fraud. And there are ways that people try to solve this problem. This is called the Sybil attack. There are ways that people have tried to solve this problem in other alternatives to Social Security, like there's a coin called WorldCoin, for example, that tries to solve this problem by scanning people's eyeballs and giving them a ticket that says, okay, one eyeball, one ticket, and then one income stream based on that. But that's not very secure either, because somebody can get one of these machines and scan a whole bunch of eyeballs and then get a whole bunch of tickets to collect multiple. So it doesn't prevent fraud either. And we wanted to create a system that didn't just create a financial safety net, but also did it in a private way. Like, we're very privacy conscious. Like, everything we do it with privacy and security in mind. So we didn't want to scan people's eyeballs. We didn't want to give people ID cards to verify their identities. What we said was we were just going to work within the existing constraints, the natural law constraints that exist already based on just how the human brain works. And, okay, so a human person can maintain about 150 meaningful relationships. That's the size that we're going to restrict the group size to then. What that means is that everybody in the group will actually know one another. They will know if someone is creating fake identities, because they'll actually know everybody in the group. So that's how we solve that problem, while protecting people's privacy.
I love that, because it's like a low-tech solution. Or I guess our brains are kind of high-tech in a way. Took millions of years of development to get here. But it's based on something that's just in nature rather than something you had to manufacture. I think that's very cool. What keeps you up at night?
The manipulation of events for nefarious reasons, whether it's a natural disaster or whether it's a terrorist attack, those kinds of events can be used to shape policy and to shape society in ways that can be negative and detrimental to society and beneficial to a select few.